Hello, everybody. Welcome to Sandow Podcast number 65. I'm Lanzer, and today is a very, very special episode, to me considered one of the most anticipated that I've done on the Foundation Company series. We'll be interviewing an actual Foundation director, someone who does this for a living, and as a reminder, the scope of the talk is an analysis of the facts. This is just a question and answer session, a learning session, where we're looking to equip the Sandbox community with good data, good information, so that we can make smart decisions in our community. A disclaimer, we do not represent the Sandbox game or the Sandbox Foundation. We are neither your financial or legal advisors, and nothing we say is to be taken as financial or legal advice. When we say the word SIP, we mean Sandbox Improvement Proposal. When we say the word DAO, we mean Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And when we use words like the SANFAM, we mean the Sandbox community, those who participate in the people, product, or purpose of the Sandbox ecosystem. That ecosystem looks a little bit like this. Everything from the gamer to the Sandbox team, the game client to the DAO, the white paper, all that comes together in the ecosystem, and today's episode is squarely on the DAO portion of that. Today we have Glenn Kennedy from Leeward Management. He'll introduce himself here in just a second, but he's an actual foundation director, professional, and in Lanzer. After 65 episodes, we'll just skip over that part. So a very brief recap. It all started in Sandow 34, where we started to look into the foundation, no pun intended, the origins of the Sandbox, where we looked into how it all came to be, and we didn't really know much at the time. I knew nothing. I still know very little, but I knew extremely nothing. So that was more of like a critical investigative look. But then as we started unfurling, what is this foundation thing all about? At Sandow 56, we did a four-hour reading of the foundation company's law, the foundation, the company's act, everything into the Cayman Islands law itself, and that was extremely eye-opening. What that did was it opened the door to us learning about how there were very, very many good reasons why one would have a foundation company in the Grand Cayman Islands and how it all came to be. Then Sandow 57, we hosted a U.S. attorney, a practicing U.S. attorney, Ernest, where we looked into the case law of DAOs, things that are shaping up in mostly the District of California, where how it's affecting the way DAOs are perceived through dispute resolution and the court system. In Sandow 59, we hosted Mel and Carolyn from Rockers Global, an international law firm and advisors to many DAOs as legal counsel. And we had a brief from them about what a foundation company was from the legal perspective. And then in Sandow 60, we did a six-hour reading of the Sandbox DAO's documents. That was the Memorandum of Association, the Article of Association, and their bylaws. And that was a very, very deep dive. So 6 hours. And Sandow 62 wasn't much better, clocking in at 4 hours. We did a reading of Star Atlas DAOs and did a comparison of the two, how they were different, both of them being foundation companies. And then last episode was episode 64. We had Carolyn back on, did a finishing Q&A with all the questions we wanted to ask back in Sandow 59, and pretty much cleared up all of the remaining cobwebs and stuff that we wanted to learn about foundation companies, how they're run, their standing, all of that. And last but not least, we're now at 65, an interview with an actual foundation director ourselves, leading us to the TLDR. So a TLDR, before we get started in this, is a foundation company. It's both the name of the Sandbox DAO, and it's a type of company in the Cayman Islands. It's very flexible in how it's structured and operates. As Carolyn mentioned, it's the very best of a corporation and a trust. An exempted company means a company that does business outside the Cayman Islands. Limited by guarantee means the members of the foundation can only lose what they put into the company. Without any share capital means there's no shares or units of ownership that were created when the company was formed. And the articles and memorandum of association, the memo being it creates the foundation company, the articles describes how it will be operated, and the bylaws establish internal business rules. Lots of businesses done in the Cayman Islands. In 1 month alone, over 1,000 companies were registered. And at last count, there's about 120, at this point, probably 130,000 represented active companies. Foundation rules are very varied and flexible. The subscriber creates a foundation company. The secretary is licensed to document, record, and certify things that happen. The director leads the foundation company. And the members, founders, officers, supervisors, managers, they all conduct the daily affairs and activities required in a foundation company. And last but not least, it's governed by Grand Cayman Islands law, specifically the Companies Act and Foundation Companies Act. But as we learned in Sandel 56, that's definitely not the only law that's applicable here, as we did our reg stack. Go take a look at 56 if you'd like to learn more. So, Glenn, if you wouldn't mind, please introduce yourself and Leeward Management, and very happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I would compliment you on your deep dive on the Cayman Islands Foundation company structure. I think it's been probably very helpful to many of our DAO members and others listening, and very comprehensive. So thank you for having me. In terms of a bit of a background, I'm the founder of Leeward Management. We are a corporate services and governance firm based in the Cayman Islands. We're just under 50 people. We do everything from form foundations as a company manager, to serving as secretary, to fulfilling director roles and supervisor roles, not only with foundations, with regular companies and funds as well, but increasingly over the last few years, foundations have been the focus of what we do.
Well, thank you very much again for coming on. And let's just jump right into it at this point. So the first question was, in the TLDR that we just mentioned, was there anything that you see that requires correction?
No, I think that's a very helpful and succinct summary of the concept and the attributes of the foundation company.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad I got that. That's really happy. I'm really happy to hear that, because it's didn't take. We've just been trying to figure this out as a community, and I'm going to end up pushing this out everywhere I can. Question number two, independent director, corporate director, licensed director. And this, and I'm pulling those words from the Directors Registration and Licensing Act. What can you tell me about, are you one specific one? How would you phrase, look at that?
Yeah, these are terms, some of which are grounded in Cayman regulation and others are more general. Suppose I'm, you know, all of those things at various times for various clients. I guess starting with independent director, that's kind of a universal concept, I would say, that describes a director who is not a member of senior management of an organization, nor an owner, nor a shareholder. So they come to the board and they're appointed in an independent capacity where they're not answering to the shareholder, the owner, which doesn't exist in a foundation, but nor are they over senior management. There are some aspects of Cayman regulation where an independent director is actually required, others where they're not. Independent directors are not required on a foundation company, but they are required on an entity which is registered as a virtual asset service provider, or FAPS. Mm. And the idea there is to give the regulator and the financial services industry in Cayman some comfort that there is an independent set of eyes on a board that's able to challenge management or ownership. That's really the concept of an independent director, and that's universal. You'll find that across public companies in most countries and in a lot of offshore centers as well. The other words you have are corporate director and licensed director via the DRLA. Corporate director might mean a few different things. That's a bit of a less specific term. It might mean a director, which is a company, which can actually happen. You can have a company serve in a director role. But I think what it probably means more commonly is a director, which is an actual board member of an organization. So you might have a large company, someone who's the, I don't know, director of sales or the marketing director, you know, some other kind of business title, which is unfortunately a bit of a poorly chosen term if you're looking at it from a lawyer's point of view, because those people are not corporate directors. They're really officers given some director term in a very loose sense. Corporate director might just mean that this person is actually a member of the board of directors as opposed to one of those other titles. And then your last concept is a licensed director via the DRLA. That's the Directors Registration and Licensing Act. That's a specific Cayman Islands regulatory law, which requires directors of quote-unquote covered entities to register with the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, pay an annual fee. The covered entity, though, is not a foundation. A covered entity is really an investment fund and certain entities that relate to investment funds. So not generally applicable in the space we're talking about here, but it's an additional regulatory measure for that industry in the Cayman Islands.
Got it. And if you wouldn't mind, is your background law, business, or something else?
Yes, I was a partner at a Canadian law firm before I moved to the Cayman Islands 20 years ago. I was then with one of the offshore law firms and did a lot of work in the fund space. Fast forward to around 2018, the Foundation Company Act was passed and some crypto projects were starting to look at using it in kind of early version of what we're doing now with Sandbox DAO and others. And I had calls from attorneys that knew I was a director in the fund space and another space and knew a fair bit about technology and was into blockchain. So one thing led to another, and I was probably one of the first directors, along with one of my other colleagues in the Cayman Islands, to actually serve as a director of a foundation company for a crypto project.
Wow. So you became the guy. Because of blockchain, and then
I was literally the only guy for some period of time all those years ago. Now there's many of us, but I might have the claim to fame as being the first game. I'm sure.
Yeah, I think we learned from Carolyn and Mel that Mel was a huge engine behind foundation company like regulations and law, but very involved.
Yeah, absolutely. She was certainly a pioneer, is a pioneer in the space. She was also very heavily involved in the design of the Limited Liability Company Act, as I understand as well.
Yeah. Well, how about that? The original director. So what would
Maybe,
you say?
I didn't say.
Yeah. But my words. What does a director, how would you describe the director's role? What do they do in a foundation company?
Yeah, well, look, it's in some ways it's very similar to being a director of any business company or fund. And in other ways, it's a bit unique and somewhat different. The directors really are the executives of the foundation. They are responsible for seeing its operation, hiring service providers, monitoring contracts, being on top of compliance, ensuring that what the foundation's doing is within the law, taking legal advice where necessary, defending or filing lawsuits if necessary. Basically, all of the executive functions of a foundation are vested in the board of directors who oversee its operation and management.
I actually have no follow-on there. I think that's pretty much sums it up. So the person who, at the end of the day, takes the responsibility of the foundation.
That's correct. Directors are the ultimate authority. There is a bit of a gloss on that with foundations.
Really? What would you...
Sorry, there may be a... well, the gloss is that there's also a supervisor role, which is unique to foundation companies. And supervisor is really seen as a stand-in for the shareholder. The way they the way the Cayman Islands enacted the foundation company was to basically create this bolt-on to the Regular Companies Act. And the Regular Companies Act obviously has a lot of roles for shareholders, you know, making fundamental changes to a company, amending its constitution, terminating it, for example. Those are shareholder actions with the classic company. And because the foundation company is a bolt-on to that, you needed to have the shareholder power exercised by someone. And there isn't a shareholder in most foundations. There can be, but there usually isn't in the crypto context. So those powers vest to the supervisor. And there is sometimes a supervisor in the picture who can, for example, remove the directors the way a shareholder can do in a regular company, or take some fundamental actions like terminate its existence or amend its constitution. But typically, just to come back to my earlier point, the director is the final say in the operation of a foundation company.
Got it. And what would you say as a director, what is a day in the life of you? How does it work?
Yeah, good question. A lot of reading, I think, is probably the
really the most succinct answer I can give you.
You know, it's a bit like, I remember the enthusiasm of getting accepted into law school all those years ago, and you know, I didn't know what law I was going to do, but you know, your vision of a lawyer is like, you know, you picture a movie like The Firm, forget the name of it now, the Tom Cruise, Jack Nicholson one with the courtroom drama. A lot of people get excited and go into, that's it, thank you. You know, people go into law thinking that's what it's all about, and in reality, law is a lot of reading and writing,
Your Honor.
Very little. Yeah, you know, I mean, a select few are courtroom lawyers and have that level of adrenaline, but most just do a lot of reading and writing, and being a director is not unlike more reading than writing, obviously. But you know, there's an awful lot of paper that comes at a board of directors in terms of agreements. So, policies, construction of the foundation, constitution, and a lot of my day is spent reading through that material and, you know, questioning it or commenting on it or ultimately approving it.
And probably focusing in on the approval aspect. So you do a lot of reading to understand it, to figure out what the intent is or what they're driving at. But at the end of the day, you're the one responsible for approving it into the constitution if need be, or elsewhere as required?
Well, it can be, you know, again, in the context of a crypto foundation, the early stage work is really reviewing a lot of the architecture and the constitution of the foundation company and maybe the wider DAO. So things like the bylaws, which you discussed with Carol and Melissa earlier, there's a lot of detail in there. That is the architecture and the governance framework that the project and the DAO is going to have. So you kind of want to get that right at the beginning, and it's easy to get it wrong, and it's not so easy sometimes to rewind on some of those things, particularly if you're talking about decentralized governance rights.
Got it. Well, what's an example of getting it wrong in your experience?
Well, I'll use the example of decentralized governance aspects. So, you know, we might start a typical foundation in what's sometimes referred to as a director-led manner, meaning that most of the powers are exercised by the director, and the director might take into account the DAO, if there is one, or the nascent DAO, if it's just being spun up, and you know, direction will be taken from the community token holders and exercised ultimately by the director in the director-led way. With progressive decentralization, those powers are often ceded to the DAO. But you could make a mistake and do that too soon. And for example, you know, architect the foundation in a way that powers need to be exercised by the DAO right away under the agreement, under the articles and bylaws. But then maybe you haven't got a DAO yet. You know, maybe there aren't any token holders. So you kind of have to think how these powers are first set out and to be exercised and how they might evolve over time. And that takes some careful consideration.
Got it. Yeah, I didn't even know that director-led and then to token holder-led was a thing until Mel and and Carolyn explained it to us. And that was a surprise to me. I think it made a lot of sense for the academic reading of the laws and then the application of them. What would you say are some misconceptions that do exist about the director's role?
Yeah, there's a few. I think one is probably that it's an easy job. You know, wouldn't that be nice? You're just a director, you just sign stuff, and you know, you can spend the rest of the time golfing around your boat or whatever you want to do. I mean, that's a pretty big mistake. There may be a class of directors out there somewhere that you know, earn a very large fee for the one public board they're on and might be semi-retired and can enjoy those things. But at least in the world I live in, being a director is a real job. I mean, I am on, you know, nearly 24 hours a day, but for when I'm asleep, firm logo or our firm motto, sorry, is always on governance. And we need to really move and be responsive to the clients we have. Things move very quickly in the space we're in, as you know. Weeks can make a huge difference to a launch, to some counterparty negotiations agreements. So being incredibly responsive and being on all the time is a requirement of the job, in my view, and that makes it a pretty demanding job.
You know, as you say that, I guess it kind of clicks in my brain that with just especially crypto folks, where it's 24/7, that always on governance that Leeward and yourself offer as a service to support matches the ethos of an international community who is trading or activities 24/7 in the blockchain space. I didn't quite consider that.
And you made a good point, which I didn't make. But global is the other point, right? So, you know, we support client projects out of Asia, Europe, obviously North America, and those people have you know, quite a few different time zones to cover, and you know, waking up in the morning means there's email from Asia and Europe overnight, and you know, when you're ready to log off and sign off for the North American clients at 6 or 7 p.m. And then they start up again with the Far East and Europe. So you know, it's a pretty dynamic piece, and it moves pretty quickly.
Yeah. So the one misconception is that it's an easy job. Were there any other that came to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's other aspects of easy. You know, the directors don't do anything.
Got it.
Service provider work, you know, that is also a misconception. Directors have a lot of risk as well, right? Directors can be sued for all kinds of things. Breach of fiduciary duty or to the foundation. This is the main heading of damages, but you could get into it with regulators as well. So in addition to being pretty demanding as a client service and in terms of keeping up on reading and documentation, the law, you need to be very careful about risk and ensure you're managing risk in an intelligent way, or you'll have a blow up on your hands at some point and that will not end.
Mm. Yeah, we definitely have a couple questions about that later on, about the fiduciary part. But as you do your job day to day, how would you define success as a director?
Good question. Look, I think for me, success is the satisfaction I derive from clients referring me to other clients and saying, you know, this is a person you can trust, and I'll, you know, I'm not hold you back, work at the speed you're working, and help the project succeed. So, you know, with that comes you know, a satisfaction and of course, increasing business as well. I some time ago brought on additional directors at Leeward and introduced them to the clients I've worked with before, firms that have referred work, and that's how we've really built our business based on that sort of reputation and referral. And to me, that's success.
I think that's, I mean, the more we delved into this subject from where we started, which is this kind of cynical, like there's the Illuminati and the offshoring and everyone's on their boat, and from where we started to there to where we are now, which is these are real people. They've got families. They've got hopes, dreams. They want to do a good job just like anybody else. They just happen to live on an island surrounded by beautiful water. That's all. That's all. It's really humanized the whole process.
The tropical weather certainly doesn't help in that misconception department, but hey, it is where it is.
Yeah. I remember, I think it was Mel, or perhaps it was Carolyn, who mentioned kind of the story behind that and how Cayman Islands came to be like a British protectorate and the whole like that. That was cool. That was cool to hear about how things happen. So increasing business.
That's quite the story.
Yeah. You saved a British monarch's family member, and then for time and forever, you know, the Cayman Islands has like a special status.
Well, there's some lore in there as well. That story you're referring to, I think they've tried very hard to dig up, you know, actual evidence of having happened.
Oh, I bet.
It was wanting. But I like the story. It's a neat one, and just the general evolution of the Caymans is a fascinating story from a financial services perspective, and to see what the islands have created now in terms of both the fund space, which is, by the way, a lot larger than what we do in the digital asset crypto space, and now with the foundation company being the leading, I guess, real world interface for DAOs. So it's quite remarkable.
Yeah, when I saw just how much business was being conducted, and I think at this point, I can definitively say there are some really good reasons why you would want to have a foundation company in the Grand Cayman Islands. Not just foundation companies, but the reason why business is the way it is there. It's an open environment. It's very flexible. There are a lot of benefits, and we've talked about that previously. But the more you look into it, these are real people, not like secret cabal, like behind the scenes trying to, you know, take over governments and all that stuff, and this the sort of things that you hear in the crypto space that I had to acknowledge, because those are real perspectives. But as we delve deeper into this, you definitely see, you know, people like Glenn, who really define success as satisfaction from clients, referring them as a trusted person, and then increasing business based on reputation referral. I mean, that's just very relatable. So what would you say are some skills that are important to have as a successful director?
Good question. I guess it would probably start with having some subject matter expertise and having something to offer. So, most of the successful directors I know have come from a profession or a business line which gives them something in terms of knowledge and expertise that they can offer to their client boards. In my case, as I mentioned, I was a lawyer, so law, as it turns out, is actually a pretty good fit with crypto. I've kind of said it jokingly sometimes, but not that jokingly, that if you're not a developer in crypto, you're probably a lawyer. And I guess that's owing down to the gray area and the legal uncertainty and the legal risk and regulatory risk that the space has experienced, at least for the last decade or so, hopefully improve it now. But having that background has helped me deliver, you know, good governance to the boards I'm on. It helps me deal with people like Mel and Carolyn and the other many lawyers that work in the space and kind of tackle the issues that are often very legal or regulatory in nature and often don't have very clear answers. So for me, it's first of all having something to offer. Now, that might not always be a lawyer. It could be that there are some founders or developers that have been on boards. And they come to the board with that experience. You know, they've launched a startup before. They've launched, maybe a Web2 company. They've been in their crypto project before. They know the game plan. They're able to see things through a lens which is different from mine. And there may also be other professionals. You know, accountants are pretty common in the Cayman Islands due to the funds industry. But and on fund boards, it's very important to have them. Sort of form of auditor, because financial reporting is a very big part of being a director and overseeing financial reporting of a fund. So I would say the first attribute is have something to offer that you can draw on from your own professional and work experience.
I mean, all this, like, once you say it out loud, it's like it like you said in the beginning, there are a lot of similarities between foundation company and just a regular company. That this sort of good business sense that you would bring to it, you also bring to a foundation company.
Yeah, right. That's it. That's it. You know, I like to think with my skill set, I have a lot to offer my boards. If I was approached to be a director of, I don't know, a mining company, say, for example, you know, maybe I wouldn't be the best candidate because I'm not a geologist and I've never run a mining company and I don't know anything really about it, so how it works. So I think you want to pick your director based on the client side now, and you pick your director based on the skill set they have to offer, and may also be some other things like connections. You know, you can pick a director who has very good connections maybe with, say, exchanges or market makers or development teams that can bring that to the project and contribute that knowledge and network. Through any other things too. I mean, obviously being responsive, as I mentioned earlier, having a team of people behind the director. Leeward, we're close to 50 people now. A lot of those people support what I do and make sure that if I happen to be on a plane or whatever, there's someone there who can, you know, answer or assure a client they'll be back online very soon, type of thing. So, you know, having that is an important aspect in the space we're in. Making sure the platform or whoever you're choosing is one which is licensed, regulated, insured. You know, there's a few other attributes to it, but I would go back to my first point, which is, you know, pick the candidate who can bring some knowledge to your project and your board.
Yeah. And pivoting now to DAOs, going down the DAO road, how would you know, or what are some indicators where you know if the foundation company is successfully serving the DAO?
That's a good question. And as you said earlier, and as I think Carolyn and Mel explained, the foundation setup is very plastic and can be configured in many different ways. Some configurations where the director's role is very limited, and that governance is decentralized and it's done by token holders through platforms like Snapshot or Tally or whatever. And the director's role in that case is
props for knowing both of those,
pretty limited, right? I mean, you're kind of, what's the, sorry, say again.
I said props for knowing both of those, by the way. I expected nothing less.
Well,
sorry,
you.
I interrupted
but
you.
It, you know, no problem. No problem. I'll take the compliment. But in those scenarios, the foundation is more of an executor, I guess. It's mm-hmm. just carrying out the will of the DAO. And you know, success is probably pretty easily measured there because the foundation is really just doing what it's told by token holders. And as long as it does what it's told, and it should do that, barring maybe illegality or some other limited factor, it will function as designed. And, you know, that should be a successful marriage between the DAO and the foundation company. There are other scenarios, I guess, kind of going back to my comment about director-led foundations or foundations which are not really a wrapper for the DAO. They're sort of another organ in the governance structure of a project. In those scenarios, you know, you could get a bit of divergence from what elements of the DAO, groups of token holders expect from the foundation and what the foundation's board thinks it should be doing. It could be, you know, various political pressures in the world. Some group wants to, you know, fork protocol and others don't, and the board doesn't want to take any risk on that. Loud members of the community do. In scenarios like that, you can start to, I guess, assess your question a little with a little bit more substance, because you know you might be a critic of the foundation at the point and say, foundation's not doing what we need to do. You know, we need to move this project forward by doing X, Y, or Z, but you know, the foundation's not doing it. The reverse could be true. The foundation could be heading, plotting a bit of a course, which the DAO is not in favor of, or elements of the DAO are not in favor. So, you know, I don't know if that means success or failure, but it might mean a divergence of opinion between the token holder community and the foundation's spirits.
Is there, you mentioned there are some configurations where the foundation company could act as another organ, which I took to mean it has a little bit more agency rather than just being doing what it's told. Is there a way to tell which one we have as a DAO?
Yeah, generally that's an answer that can be found in the bylaws and the articles of the foundation company. If you look at a project like, say, Ape Foundation or Arbitrum, those are heavily DAO forward or empowered DAOs, I suppose, where the foundation role is going to be more limited. And some director of the company, and you'll find that by looking at those documents, which are, you know, I mentioned those two examples because they're online and they're transparent and you can read them. Mm-hmm. They have language in the bylaws which talks about, for example, token holder resolutions and token holder voting mechanics and things like, you know, voting thresholds for proposals and SIPs or PIPs or APEs or whatever the acronym is for the proposal mechanism. Mm-hmm. But when you see that in the documents, that's a signal that this is a decentralized governance project. They may have different degrees of decentralization. Some might say, you know, on the passing of a proposal, the foundation shall implement it. Others might say, you know, that the foundation may implement it. The may implies a bit more discretion to the directors, where it's not completely the direction is not completely set by the DAO, but there's some reserved power by the directors. So there's a spectrum there of governance arrangements and. If you look in those documents and a project's constitution and bylaws, you'll see where that project is on the spectrum.
Yeah, I'm showing right now that timeline event slide that Mel and Carolyn gave us, where it, from the incorporation over to the sliding scale of token holder led from director led, and would you say that when you're you said Arbitrum and what was that second entity?
Apecoin,
got it. Right. Which just recently had a very seismic shift in its approach. But another podcast, another day. Yeah. All right. How do you see the relationship between the DAO and the foundation company? I learned from Mel and Carolyn that it can be that between the token holder led and director led. The various spectrum of the director-led as vested with much of the authority and power needed to execute, and then as a sliding scale over to token holder-led, either relinquishes or, with updating the bylaws, doesn't have as much power. How do you see that relationship?
You've accurately set out the kind of spectrum or the where the pathway, I guess, that is followed in terms of decentralized governance. Few of them come out of the gate as token holder led. Typically, the difference between one and the other in your example is a function of time and community growth. So, you know, out of the gate at incorporation, a lot of them are director led and will progressively decentralize governance to become token holder led over time. That's a fairly common approach, and it's usually one that is calibrated with the growth of the DAO and the scope of the project and the maturity of the DAO. So, you know, ensuring that sometimes it might be too early to decentralize. I know that might be anathema to some purists in the space, but you know, the project may have just launched its application, its network, its protocol, in its very infancy, and the foundation there might be more interested in sort of shepherding that growth and making sure that the vision for the project is carried out, and the DAO really only comes to have controlling powers over the protocol at a later point when it's sufficiently decentralized, when there's enough people, and you don't want, you know, you could say, well, how can that be? Why should we let, you know, two foundation directors have all the power over the foundation? But in a very early day in a project's life, you know, there might only be a couple of token holders. So, you know, either way, you're going to be fairly centralized. So I guess to go back, you know, typically they come out of the gate director led, and over time they will often decentralize. centralized to the point of being token holder led. That's not always true. Some foundations come out of the gate that are token holder led, and they're, you know, big enough launch with a big enough and dispersed group of token holders that the token holder governance will start from day one.
So it almost sounds like that relationship is with, you know, on a good day, let's say ideally the foundation company is the shield, is the thing that keeps the DAO on track to, if it wants to become token holder led, it matures into what that is.
I think it's a fair statement. There's certainly a role there for the directors of a foundation in shepherding that growth, that early growth of the protocol and the ultimate decentralization.
All right, moving right along. What responsibility, and I mean, at this point, I think I'm starting to hear a pattern. At what responsibility does a foundation company have to the DAO?
Well, yeah, there's some legal answers to that, and then there's obviously some variability from project to project. But typically, I guess just coming back to the director's role, the duties of the director are usually owed to the foundation company only and not to a broader group. It's a sort of a legal construct, which is, I guess, in keeping with the concept of a corporation. And then added to that, though, are sometimes a constitution, not the memorandum and articles, but a separate document constitution, which talks about the overall construct of the project, and the bylaws, which deal with token holder voting. So it may be that through those other instruments, there is a sort of an expanded set of duties and responsibilities owed to the DAO and to the wider project. But the core legal duties of the director are to act in the best interests of the company, of the foundation company.
Yeah, earlier when you said that it was responsibility to the foundation company only, what I would read there is not the DAO, not the thing it's wrapping, but the actual legal entity.
Yeah, and that's right. But, you know, what is in the best interest of the foundation company is then the next question. And if you're talking about a foundation company, which is there to serve a DAO and enable project to, you know, contract and own hold real world assets or whatever, really its objects are to further the DAO and further the project and further the protocol. So it's not, in my view, fair to say that even though the legal duties are said to be owed only to the foundation company, that you can ignore as a director the wider DAO and the community and the token holders. So it's a little bit of a circular discussion, as you're probably picking up on, but that's the construct we're working from.
Yeah, probably some healthy disagreement, I imagine, within the community itself, and certainly on the lower end, it's called the voters end. Being in the receiving end of, you've got a foundation director who can do what he wants, so to speak, in quotations, or she do what they want. But then you've got the foundation company that's far away on the other side of the world, and offshoring and boats and yachts, and then just things start to take a life of its own from there. But I think what's been clear between you, Mel, and Carolyn is you don't just get to ignore the DAO, especially if the objects are specific in furthering the DAO's growth, furthering the protocol, as you mentioned. And then there are all sorts of mechanisms in place to ensure a check and balances on both sides. You check and balancing us, the DAO, and then the DAO check and balancing the foundation company. It seems like there's a symbiosis there in an ideal scenario.
Yeah, that's very well described. And as to the check and balance at the decentralized end, at the DAO-led project end of the spectrum, there is typically, or often anyway, a right of removal that the DAO might have to remove directors or remove a supervisor who can in turn remove directors. So these are not, at that end, at the spectrum anyway, sort of a dictatorship of the foundation anymore. They're their organizations where the directors are subject to removal by the DAO if they are not seen to be doing what they're supposed to be doing.
And let's take a maybe less obvious case, which would be if it's not just, say, the director, you've got everyone on the side, the director's on the side of the DAO pursuing to the objects, but then the lower levels management, like the officers or VPs of sort, they start becoming, I'm just going to use some terrible phrasing, you know, bureaucrats, you know, just getting in the way of the objects and the purpose. But then there's a situation where the director maybe just hasn't taken any action against them. So the DAO might view those lower level officers as getting in the way of the DAO and not acting in the best interest of the DAO. How does that, like in that hypothetical, what are your thoughts on, it's not the director that's the problem, but maybe the lower levels, and it's all interpretation, people's viewpoint.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess one of the very first questions you asked, or, you know, what are the director's duties? And, you know, it's to the duties are really to oversee the operation of the foundation. So if there are officers that are not performing or doing their job poorly, or you know, seem to have very little support amongst the DAO for the direction they're plotting and the day-to-day actions they're taking, that would quite likely become a discussion at the foundation company board level as to whether those officers are the right people to have in place.
And how would the DAO raise that to a foundation company to begin with, to alert you to that?
It could be a lot of different ways. Can sometimes be informal. Large token holders or groups of token holders might reach out and say they're not agreeing with the direction of the project, that they see, you know, Mr. or Mrs. X as not the appropriate leader for the time, or maybe they suggest someone else. Maybe they suggest adding people to the kind of management side of the project. Could be that way, or it could also be formally through proposals to either remove or add officers.
Huh. I guess that makes actually a lot of sense when you say it like that. We could just, you know, put a proposal out, which would be the will of the DAO, and any other proposal. So reaching out to you informally, and I mean, all I'm hearing at this point is good business sense, like the sort of thing that you would conduct in normal business operations, you know, email, phone call, writing them a letter. Just the DAO adds the, you know, snapshot or tally votes and formalized voting with token holders.
That's it, you know, and you just said a judgment, right? And you know, exercising powers and with a fair bit of discretion and in a reserved way, you know, these are the kind of attributes that I think should be present in a board of directors. You know, not really maybe getting into it with various factions that might exist and personalizing it and becoming a broad for, you know, one group within the community versus another. You know, my view of exercising those kind of powers in situations like that is to be very judicious and reserved and exercise good judgment carefully. When directors start becoming politicians, this is when the governance construct can start to break down, if you ask me.
I think that's very well said. I think that makes it pretty clear. So I had an episode some time ago, it feels like it was so long ago, but when the reading of the Cayman Islands Law, I think it was, where I was trying to figure out, with the reading of it, all these positions started popping up, you know, the director, the officers, and each law had its own, sometimes its own word. I create a table out of this, a terminology translation table, where it would use director in one, it would use, you know, officers in another, and is all these different positions started, and I was so confused. I called it my triangle of confusion, and It basically was all of the roles: subscriber, director, secretary, supervisor, founder. How do they interact with each other? How does that work?
Yeah, there's a sort of an alphabet soup of terms and acronyms that can apply to a foundation company. Remember, the foundation company was not designed to do what it's doing now in the context of DAOs and crypto projects. It was there really as an alternative to a trust for mainly people who would look to use the jurisdiction from civil law countries. So, you know, Europeans don't know what a trust is. Well, they know what it is, but it doesn't exist under their laws. So the foundation company was designed to be more familiar for that. And it was designed sort of as a vehicle, you know, to manage, you know, estate planning, maybe carry on some dynastic family business that you know, will hopefully exist for hundreds of years, and we'll need to have a mechanism to, you know, roll with the changes in the family over generations. That's what it was designed for and historically used for in Europe. Turns out it actually is a pretty good vehicle for DAOs, in that the foundation exists in a tax neutral jurisdiction, the Cayman Islands, with a very familiar and established legal system, staffed by very competent law firms that have been in business for years. So these things just sort of aligned, and with some ingenuity on the part of some practitioners in Cayman, sort of repurposed this vehicle for DAOs and foundation companies. So a lot of, to go back to your question, a lot of the kind of verbiage that exists in and around the foundation company, beneficiary, founder, for example, they kind of are drawn from that use case that I described, the original created use case. So the founder might be the man or woman who started the business empire and is now in his or her 70s and wants to set up a foundation for the two generations of descendants to own this very, you know, well-known iconic business that he or she created. Founders in the context of crypto foundations and DAO facing entities is not commonly used. There is one, at least one law firm I know of that does use the founder concept, and they sort of suggest
TTA, right?
That's right. Yeah. So TTA, you know, they take the view that the founder is an important, I guess, break on governance and can be powers of removal of a rogue director, for example, or even a rogue supervisor. And they kind of, I think, position it as we're a law firm, we've been around forever, we're trusted, we can exercise these, you know, break glass in case of fire type powers as the founder if things really go bad. And some founders and some projects think that's very helpful. Other law firms don't use the founder concept at all, so it falls away. And then the beneficiary concept, again, you know, going back to my example, the family business wrapped in a foundation company, you know, those would be the grandchildren and whatever, typically, that have a beneficial interest in the foundation company. We don't use that concept in the crypto sense either. So token holders are not beneficiaries of foundations. Their rights exist only as to the token they hold, and the powers they have are granted under the bylaws or the articles. So we don't use the beneficiary concept. So founder and beneficiary, put that aside as something pertaining more to, you know, estate planning and you know, generational businesses. Secretary, supervisor, subscriber, director, those are very applicable to what we do. The director, I won't say anything more about as I've been speaking about it for most of this podcast. The supervisor, as I mentioned earlier, is sort of a stand-in for the shareholder to, you know, make this legal construct work, and can have powers of removal, appointment, or sometimes very little power at all. And then the last two roles I'll touch on, and feel free to ask me about others if we missed any, but secretary, that's actually, I think, a bit of a poorly named term.
Yeah.
Typically, a secretary is someone who sort of keeps the corporate records and you know, has custody of the minute book and makes sure filings are made and you know, sort of supports the board in terms of minute taking, drafting corporate resolutions. That's what a secretary is historically. In this case, though, the secretary role is actually more of an AML control role. I would have probably called it a money laundering reporting officer or an AML responsible person. Yeah, because the real function of the secretary is in a foundation company context is to look into any transfers of assets into a foundation, which are gratuitous, i.e. not paid for, and ensure that the assets coming in are not derived of criminal origins. So, you know, that's a money laundering control, really. So that's what the secretary does. And that's quite a commonly active thing. Secretaries have to be licensed entities. Leeward is a licensed entity. So we act as secretary for a lot of foundations, and quite often assets will be transferred into a foundation, be it tokens or intellectual property or cash sometimes in the form of stable coins. And we'll have to look at the source of those assets and say, okay, well, the tokens were minted, so we're okay with this. Or the USDC came from a coinless sale, which was, you know, done with AML controls, so we're okay with it. That's really what the secretary does. And then a subscriber is, as you said, this is and in your TLDR, but this is the entity, Leeward, quite often, which is the initial guarantor subscriber to the memorandum of association, which creates the foundation, and that's just a point in time role, really.
Got it. And say, like, when you have a meeting, how do these, like, you call the meeting to order? Who is doing what in the meeting at that point?
For me?
Like when you have like a board meeting or a foundation company meeting, you call the meeting to order. Mm-hmm. Who is doing what in that meeting? Like what is the, if there is a founder, what is the founder doing? What is the supervisor doing? Is it just the director most of the time talking? How does that work?
Yeah. Well, typically it's only the directors.
Okay.
Founders don't meet at board meeting. Suppose they could be invited in theory, as could the supervisor. Sometimes supervisors are invited to a board meeting, but not always. And typically they don't have a right of attendance. But, as to the kind of process of a board meeting, it's typically called by one director with, you know, some number of days notice. Sometimes that notice is waived if it's a, you know, rush item or we have to approve a contract. Other times you'll let the notice run and have the meeting on the day specified in the notice. The agenda is set. It could be set out in the notice of meeting. So we're going to have a meeting to discuss, you know, this contract approval or this amendment to some other item of business, and the meeting will proceed to nominate a chairman, which would be one of the directors, and to work through the business. I'm sure quorum is there to disclose any conflicts, and then proceed to the business of the meeting, majority rules, and after that, minutes are prepared and filed in the minimum.
Is not nomination of the chairman, is that like a temporary role just for the meeting, or is there a more persistent role there?
Typically the former. So a chairman is a chairman of the meeting, and that might be a different director each time, or maybe usually the same director. It's different from the kind of chairman of the board term that you might, you know, see in public companies.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that's what I was getting at. Yeah. All right. Secretary must be licensed by SEMA. When does the director need to be? I think you covered that earlier. When it's a covered entity.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. And when it's not a covered entity, does an independent director, do they have any licensing requirements?
Yes and no. So it depends where they live, I guess, is the answer to that question. So if the director was in the US or the UK, I'm not aware of any licensing requirement in those jurisdictions to be a director of a company. The Cayman Islands doesn't require directors to be resident in the Cayman Islands. So that person resident in the US or the UK can be a director of a Cayman Islands foundation. If they live in the Cayman Islands, then there are some local laws which would apply. So you know, are they employed by a licensed company manager like Leeward, then there's no further licensing required. If they're not employed by a firm like Leeward, then they would need the authorization of a work permit to be in the Cayman Islands and fulfill a director role.
Okay, I see. Okay. So work visa requirement type things, and they're just natural citizens. And
yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right.
That's correct. Got it. No different than if I were to move to Miami and wanted to, wait tables or something, I'd need a green card or a, you know, work permit or something to do it.
Got it. That makes sense. So what would be the major advantage of having, you know, I guess you could say a natural born citizen of the Grand Cayman Islands be a director of a foundation company in the Grand Cayman Islands?
Well, the main reason why projects would choose to have a director in Cayman is to, you know, ensure that the mind and management of the project of the foundation company is in the Cayman Islands. And you probably have not accomplished very much if you're looking for a crypto-friendly jurisdiction and you choose to incorporate in the Cayman Islands, but then, you know, remote control the foundation from London or New York or Hong Kong. If you're doing that, you're probably at risk regulatory-wise, tax-wise, there are other reasons of being said to be, you know, resident in one of those other places. So being in the Cayman Islands is important, obviously. It's probably the number one reason. But then the other reasons are really expertise and specialization.
Yeah, yeah. The network effect, as you might have heard in the crypto space. Yeah, all the things you would need to do, conduct good business and be successful in the environment that you're in. See, this is all just starting to just make sense. It's very civilized.
All right, well, I'm glad I've been able to shed some light on it.
Yeah, last couple questions we're on now. Let's get to the fiduciary thing. The director is a fiduciary of, is it the objects, the members, beneficiaries, some, all of it?
Well, they have fiduciary duties to act. Fiduciary duties owed to the foundation company. So that is a duty of utmost good faith. So it means things like not acting with a conflict of interest, not being interested in contracts that you as a director are then approving by the foundation. It means to fulfill your duties with honesty and integrity. Those are the types of concepts of duties that are owed to the foundation company as a director.
Okay, so it's to the foundation company itself. So we're not talking like just the objects or just the members. Whatever the foundation company is there to do, the entity itself is what you owe the fiduciary duty to. Yes?
Yeah. So my answer was you know, in response to the concept of a fiduciary duty, I think we're now mentioning the objects and the director will need to, you know, discharge his or her duties and govern the foundation in accordance with the objects. That's another very important point, right? So if the object were to, you know, further the use of the protocol and the network, then, you know, going off to, I don't know, have the foundation company open an ice cream stand or something like that is not in keeping with the objects. And the director could be liable for taking decisions like that that are in keeping with the objects.
Yeah, that makes sense. Discharge the duties and govern the foundation company in accordance with its objects. Okay, I think one of the last things that I wanted to get here was I created a little flowchart that I sent you, and that flowchart was my best representation of what actually happens when you try and create a foundation company. Were there any adjustments? Carolyn recommended that I take out the whole Seaman licensed director, so I put a big X there. What adjustments would you have for me? Oh, you see my rectangle of confusion there on the far right, which is no longer confusion. Now I get it.
Yeah, I think it's a it's a good flow chart. I'm just trying to bring it up here now. It seems to be, my computer's gone slightly sleepy as I've been talking. I think Carolyn's suggestion of removing the SEMA licensing is probably on the basis that that's already there, that already exists. There's already a Leeward willing to incorporate a foundation, and it is already SEMA licensed. So that's a good change. The rest of it, though, no, I feel like you've set out graphically the general process for forming a foundation, and over on the right side of it, a lot of the kind of inputs needed for it.
Okay. Well, Glenn, is there anything that you'd like to leave us with? Any closing remarks?
Well, first, a big thank you. I think that what you've done here in this series is incredibly helpful. Some people have firsthand knowledge of the foundation company and the formation process and how they work in practice from having worked with projects, but probably a lot of other people don't really know the inner workings of the foundation company and the legal concepts that go with it and the people behind it and the attorneys and, in my case, the director. So I think you've done a great public service here to both your DAO and to any other listeners out there wondering about some of these things and how they actually work. So a big thank you from me and from the Leeward team.
Yeah, well, the pleasure is all mine. I have thoroughly enjoyed trying to poke prod and examine and turn this around and upside down to try and figure out what exactly. I mean, it really surprises me that a year ago, almost 13 months ago, the Sandbox DAO came out with its foundation company and the DAO. And it was very sudden at NFC Lisbon, where I interviewed Cyril, the current DAO administrator, and Seb, the COO, and they explained that was by design. Like, they wanted to be like, bam, the DAO, and bam, the foundation company, and progressive decentralization, and let's go vote. And the reaction from the community was, first of all, what is a DAO? What is a foundation company? What are all these things you're saying? And it's now, like, we all laugh about it for the most part, but it wasn't the reception they were expecting, and most of it was just confusion on our end. Like, what are we supposed to do with this thing that we now have? And that's what really started this podcast, was an attempt to understand, what is this DAO thing? And then the DAOs led to foundation companies, and now here we are toward the end. Oh, Glenn just left for a second. But what is a foundation company? And yeah, now here we are, episode 65. And the thing looks a little bit weird, but it's okay. Glenn gave us so much of his time, so, and perhaps it was time for him to go. There we go. So here we are at the end, and 65 episodes later, Glenn just imparted a lot of knowledge, and that knowledge was extremely helpful to understanding foundation companies and what it is that we do. So. I thank Glenn very much for his time and all of the wisdom that he just imparted on us and how foundation companies are run. We went through our questions, and I will likely do a recap episode here in the near future from episode 34, covering 56, 57, 59, 60, 62, 64, and now episode 65. So thank you all for your time, and thank you very much, Glenn, for giving us a look into what does it mean to be a director. All right, everybody. Have a great day.